The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Scott Warren, co-founder and CEO of Generation Citizen, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Critical to a healthy democracy is an engaged and informed citizenry. And for most of us listening, that all began back in civics class. But today, when 77% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 34 can't name one U.S. senator representing their state, it may be time to reimagine civics class, which is precisely what Generation Citizen has done. And it's a pleasure to have with us their co-founder and CEO, Scott Warren. Good evening, Scott, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Great to be here. Excited to talk about it.
Your father was with the State Department, so you spent most of your childhood living overseas in Latin America and Africa. So it's quite ironic that you have started an organization that teaches civics in U.S. schools, a class that you never really attended yourself.
That's true.
What was your impetus for starting Generation Citizen?
Yeah, no, that's all very true. So I grew up in San Diego, and when I was 8 years old, my dad, who is a criminal defense attorney, had the definition of a midlife crisis and decided to join the State Department and move abroad. And so we spent 8 to 18 living in Latin America, East Africa. And after I got over the shell-shocked fact of leaving San Diego, I was able to have a lot of experiences where I recognized the power of democracy. Mm-hmm. I saw the first truly democratic elections in Kenya in 2002, which actually worked. They're having a lot of problems with democracies there right now. I saw a coup in Ecuador where I graduated from high school in 2005. And had all these experiences really realizing the power of individuals coming together to make a collective difference, but how fragile democracy could be too. So my parents were living in Zimbabwe when I was in college at Brown, and I was able to meet opposition activists there that were putting their lives on the line for democracy and for a country that would actually respect their opinions. And so I think for me, coming back to this country and attending college here, I realized that young people really wanted to make a difference. This trope of young people being apathetic is totally misguided.
Yeah.
But they didn't see government and politics as the way to do so. And I had grown up seeing all these people so excited to participate, seeing democracy as the lifeblood of a country. And so that disconnect between that excitement and energy that I had seen abroad and somewhat of the stasis that I saw here was one of the reasons that inspired me to think about how do we really think about reinvigorating our democracy. And I do think it begins with our young people.
Yeah, I agree. Well, civics class used to be very central to our curriculum. I remember when I used to come home with my report card, it was every bit as important as math or English, but less and less so in recent years. What are some of the things that contributed to this marginalization?
I think it's a few things. There's some folks, point to the Sputnik moment. And the moment that Sputnik was launched and all of a sudden we engaged in the space war with the Soviets and science and math and what now is called STEM was emphasized throughout the curriculum. And as part of that, I think we got worried that we were falling behind the rest of the world in science skills, and also that we weren't preparing young people for the new economy and an emerging economy. And so civics got seen as a nice to have. We need to ensure that young people know what it means to compete in a new and emerging marketplace, and teaching them how to participate in our democracy really isn't as important. I do think that some of it actually has to pertain to we live in, what may have been called an emerged democracy, something that was a little bit more established. And I think we just didn't see it as important to educate young people to participate in it. And in our education system at large, we've seen a little bit more of a focus on standardized testing, test scores, and civics is seen as a soft skill that gets thrown to the side. And so it's just not something that schools have been prioritizing. It really is, if students learn math, science, English, three languages, get PE, health class, and maybe we can talk about civics. It's seen as the last priority.
Well, how proficient are, let's say, eighth graders in civics? What do they know and what do they not know?
So one of the interesting things is the National Assessment of Education Progress, the NAEP test, actually shows that eighth graders test worse on civics and history than any other subject. So it's really dire. And I think you can point to specific facts, like the fact that only a third of people in this country can name all three branches of government, and a third can't name any at all. More than 75% of young people can't name one of their U.S. senators. There's a lot of facts, and then there's the belief part of it. And I think one of the most dire stats right now is that you have about a quarter of young people, and this is much more than in prior times, but a quarter of young people actually believe that living in a democracy is a bad thing and not something that we should aspire to. And so,
and only 33% of them think it's an essential thing.
Right. And so you can't actually live in a surviving democracy if people actually don't believe that it's important. So I think sometimes we think a lot about the facts, but it's the motivations and the skill sets and the beliefs in democracy that are really important too, and things that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that democracies are under assault across the globe.
Yeah.
It's just not in the United States. It's countries
right.
all over the place. You see a lot of these emerging countries now looking to the Chinese model
right.
as maybe something that they should consider emulating. And I've heard other people say that democracies were created when information was scarce
mm-hmm.
and that they're just not as effective when there's an abundance of information. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of times I talk about Kenya as this story that inspired me. And just in the past few weeks, you've seen a lot of challenges there where you had the opposition candidate actually take the people's oath of office and the current president, Uhuru Kenyatta, basically shut down the TV stations for, 5 days.
Yep.
I think to the China example, one thing you're seeing is with the global economic downturn, I think people are looking to different forms of government that can actually provide for them and their families. The form of government becomes less important than who's putting food on the table. And you have seen China and some of the countries in East Asia that have promised and delivered on beneficial economic results without having full democracies. I don't think that's sustainable. I think on the aggregate, if you look across the world, countries that have more participation have less income inequality. And I also think that the notion that democracies are reliant on people not having a ton of information doesn't give people enough credit. And I think that we're in an ecosystem now where there's a ton of challenges, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's part of the problem when you talk about democracy is, yes, there is a problem that we're not educating people to know what it means to participate, but we're also not educating them on the values and behaviors that are associated with becoming part of a democracy as well. So how do you talk to people that don't agree with you? How do we get past this polarization? I think all of that starts in our schools. And
mm-hmm.
so thinking about teaching democracy is less about this civics knowledge piece, but more about this all-encompassing what does it mean to be an effective citizen is something that I think is important too.
Well, let's turn our attention to that. The program you bring to schools is something that you call Action Civics.
Mm-hmm.
Describe for us how it works.
So part of the things that I think we thought about in starting Generation Citizen is that there were two problems. One is that civics wasn't taught to the extent that it used to be, as you said. And the other is that when it is taught, it's seen as the most boring class in school. Here are the three branches of government. Here's how a bill becomes a law. Go take a test. And the most effective way to learn something is through doing it. You learn science by actually engaging in science experiments. You
right.
learn STEM by doing robotics and actually creating robots. And
experiential learning.
Exactly. And so Action Civics, I mean, we put the action in front of civics and everything changes, but Action Civics is really about learning civics by doing civics.
Mm-hmm.
And what we think we actually do is create a real world lab for civic engagement. So our students in middle and high schools across the country choose very local issues that they care about. That's another thing that I think has been missing from our political realm is the importance of local activism. They'll choose local issues like teen jobs, violence in their communities, public transit comes up a lot in New York, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
And then they take real action. They meet with city council members, they meet with state legislators, they mobilize their fellow students, and they take action. And through that process of actually taking action, especially at the local level, they're actually learning how the process works and learning how they can use their voices to make a difference in it.
So the class picks a single issue for
mm-hmm.
that year and then works on it all year to see if they can effectuate that change.
Exactly. And so the process of choosing an issue is actually challenging in its own right, because you have some students that say, we really want to focus on the fact that, the MTA prices have gone through the roof, and some folks that want to focus on immigration or want to focus on police community relations. And they actually have to, through a consensus building process, come to one issue. And again, I think that's a really important part of the democratic process is realizing you can't all get what you want.
Yeah.
You have to figure out how to compromise and select one issue. But they select one issue as a class. They figure out what's the root cause of that problem. How can we actually take some sort of real action? And so, that looks like students in the Bronx that look at gentrification and affordable affordable housing, and then as a root cause, find a city council bill that would provide tax incentives to landowners that provide more affordable housing. I mean, these are 11th graders working on a deep public problem in that nature. Mm-hmm. Another example that I like to throw out is that we had a class in Brooklyn that looked at cafeteria food, because everybody looks at cafeteria food, right? So I think that the normal instinct is to say, we want better cafeteria food. You know, let's march for better cafeteria food. They looked at the root cause and determined that just like restaurants throughout the city actually get a sanitation score for how clean their restaurant is, so do school cafeterias. Mm-hmm. Every school cafeteria gets a grade, but they're not required to be public.
Ah.
So they actually worked on an assembly bill law that would require schools throughout the state to make their sanitation grades public and got that law passed.
That is very cool.
So through that process, they actually understand how the legislature works, mm-hmm. and how they can focus on more systemic change rather than just focusing on a specific problem in their
school. And what is the theory of change that you're bringing to this work?
So I think what we fundamentally believe is that our democracy will be stronger if we have more people participate in it. And in order to ensure that we have a strengthened democracy with more robust participation, we need to ensure that we're teaching young people before they actually turn voting age, right? I think that that's a challenge that we often see in democracy work, is that seemingly we only treat people as participants in a democracy once they turn 18. So I sometimes see it as, you know, when you turn 16, you can get your driver's license, but you don't wake up at 16 with your driver's license on your doorstep.
Get behind a Tesla.
Yeah. You have to get a permit. You have to take lessons. You practice. So I really see what we're doing as a driver's education for our democracy. How can we train young people before they actually take the reins?
That's a great metaphor. And I think that's what's really distinctive about this is that this is an in-school class. Mm-hmm. This is not an extracurricular activity or a club. And I guess that's really central to your mission in terms of this broad participation.
Yeah, we see this as just as important as math class or science class or English class. Mm-hmm. And I think that sets us apart. There's a lot of great after-school extracurricular activities. But if we really want to ensure our mission is that every student in this country receives mm-hmm. an effective action civics education, if we really want to do that, we need to figure out how does this become embedded in education systems across the country. And a more macro question is how can we ensure, we often talk about the fact that, you know, the reason that public schools in this country were created was to create engaged and active citizens. The reason public schools exist are to preserve our democracy. But what does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, we've definitely gotten away from the civic mission of schools. And so I think one thing that we're thinking about is not only how do we get action civics in schools, but how do we get schools writ large to recognize their obligation to create cultures that embody the democratic spirit that we want to see throughout our country. Oftentimes, I think some of the most undemocratic institutions in America are public schools. They're very autocratic. And so our curriculum is very student-centered. They choose the issues that they care about. They choose how they take action. It's really up to them. And that's something that I think is germane to effective education writ large.
Have you seen an increase in the interest around action civics since the 2016 presidential campaign? We have the Women's March. I mean, are young people sort of getting more and more engaged around these issues the last 24 months?
Yeah. I started Generation Citizen in 2008, 2009. And I joke with people that for the first 4, 5, 6 years of starting, I'd tell people, oh, you know, we're all about educating young people to be active citizens. They're getting civics back in the classroom, and eyes would glaze over. You know, who else can I talk to? And now people say, oh, my God, that's so important.
Yeah.
How do we get civics everywhere? So there is more interest. We're strictly nonpartisan. And I think it would be a mistake to point to one election as causing a demise or decay in our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's been going on for a while.
Sure.
And so I think that the fact that there's more interest is undoubtedly a positive. And I guess the question for us is how do we maintain that interest? Our democracy is not going to get better, you know, through one election. It's going to get better through actually focusing on the foundations of our democracy. So I think there is more interest, and we have to figure out how to really sustain that.
Yeah, and one of the byproducts of what you do is that there's a lot of collaboration in this. And
mm-hmm.
from what I remember from school, it's pretty individualistic. So getting groups to work together like this, which is going to be what they're going to be doing in the real business world when
right.
they get out, is really something special.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. A lot of times when I talk to students after they're done with Generation Citizen and ask what was different for you about this experience, they point to that exact fact, that their success was dependent on the success of a group. And I think in many ways, our education system has become very individualized. You think about standardized tests.
Yeah.
Students are judged based on how they do as individuals. If you think about a democracy, you know, e pluribus unum, where it's about the individual and how it works together as a collective. If schools don't reflect that, then our democracy won't either. So it's a very collaborative process. There's challenges when it's collaborative. We all remember in school whenever we did group projects, you know, I think we thought, oh, the one person takes the lead and everybody falls back. In this curriculum, you have different groups working on different aspects of the action. So you'll have one group that's responsible for getting in touch with the city council member. You have one group that's responsible for the social media campaign. You'll have one group that's responsible for doing research. They can't be successful unless they're all successful.
Good.
And I think that's something that's, you know, important for our democracy.
Yeah.
We're all better off when we're all better off.
Get those nodes working together.
Yeah.
You have a Generation Citizen Civics Day where students present the issues they have taken action on to community members and elected officials. You've been to a whole bunch of us, of them. Share with us some of the things that you've witnessed on these days.
Yeah, it's always one of my favorite parts of the semester. And I always go up to students and ask, what did you think about Generation Citizen at the beginning and what do you think now?
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of interesting because a lot of times at the beginning, and I think this is so reflective of what young people think, they, you know, said, oh, we thought this was going to be dumb. People came into class and thought and said, you're going to take action and make a difference on issues you care about. And their eyes would roll and they'd say, you know, that's not going to happen. And then at Civics Day, what happens is that they engage with public officials and community members from all over the city. We're in New York and Rhode Island and Boston and the Bay Area and Oklahoma and Texas, and I get to go to all of them. And it's just really inspiring to see how active and energetic these young people are to present on the issues they care about. So at this past New York City Civics Day, I remember talking to a group of young women, and their issue was figuring out, how do we work with the city to get more monuments built for African-American abolitionists? So we have a hot topic going on in the mm-hmm. city and across the country of, you know, are we taking down Confederate monuments? What are we doing about other monuments? What are we doing about the Christopher Columbus monument here? And they said, you know, that conversation can continue to happen, but, you know, we're African-American and we don't see, you know, any monuments across the city that represent us.
Yeah.
And so they're actually working with the city, you know, to get that done. I went to Austin, and just the number of classes there that were focused on immigration. Because in Austin specifically, they've been sort of at war with the state, Austin trying to become a sanctuary city, the state of Texas pushing back. And you had students whose family members were deported, who felt they're at risk themselves. And so it's actually very sobering talking to, you know, 14 and 15-year-olds that are dealing with issues that really affect them. And I think that's one of the most powerful parts of Action Civics, is that you're not dealing with the theoretical components of democracy, where I feel like so many of our arguments actually lie. But you're dealing with young people who, you know, are taking action on gun control because a fellow eighth grader was shot. I mean, these are issues that are so fundamental to who they are as individuals. And I think that's the power of democracy, taking action on issues that actually really affect us.
Yeah. And you have some dramatic results at the end of a school year. 72% have an increased knowledge about civics and a whole bunch of other things. You're still a relatively young organization. Have you any longitudinal data at all? Are you beginning to work on it to see whether the seeds that were planted through this class continue on?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We think about our success in terms of three main indicators: civic knowledge, so how much they know about the political process; civic motivation, so how much they actually want to participate
mm-hmm.
and feel like they can make a difference; and then civic skills, which I think are some of the most important work, as you were talking about: critical thinking, group work and collaboration, oral and written persuasive communication. So can they actually make an argument? So in from beginning of semester to end of semester, we've seen dramatic increases in those results. You know, what is going to be the devil in the details is, are our students voting at higher rates?
Yeah.
Are they leaders in their community? And qualitatively, we've seen that. We've seen some of our students run for office. We've seen our students continue to stay involved in this type of work. But that's going to be a priority going forward, is actually proving that this leads to increased voting rates, that this leads to the ability to work across boundaries. This leads to, you know, actually understanding who your public officials are, really at the local level too. I mean, if you look at, despite all the activism, if you look at the 2017 New York City mayoral, you had, you know, about 20% participation. I want to see our young people voting at really high rates in local elections, because I think that's really where they can have an impact.
Well, speaking of that, one of the things you've been advocating for is lowering the voting age to 16, at least for local elections. What's the case you make here, and how has the response been to it?
Yeah, so it's interesting. One of the things that we thought a lot about is, how can we ensure that we tell young people that your voice can actually matter, and it can matter now? And so a lot of times when we talk to people about lowering the voting age to 16, and we are talking exclusively about local elections, people say that's ridiculous, 16-year-olds don't know anything. But the argument is, 18 might not be a great age to start voting at. Young people are either in college or they're in the workforce and they're not thinking of voting. And you can actually show a downward trend. And we lowered the voting age to 18 in 1971 as a result largely of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And there's been a downward trend in voting since then amongst youth populations. And there's a whole host of reasons, but one might be that 18 is not a great age. And so what we're saying is, you know, if we can get young people to vote in local elections while they're still at home, while they're still in school, and again, we're just talking local elections, it will help to create lifelong voters.
Yeah.
If you vote in your first election, you're statistically much more likely to vote in subsequent elections. And so you have three cities in Maryland, Tacoma Park, Hyattsville, and Greenbelt that have lowered the voting age to 16. We have an active effort in Washington, D.C. And I will say in San Francisco in 2016, we had a voter referendum. About 3 months before the election, we did a poll. And 55% of people thought that there was no way we should lower the voting age. They were against it. 30% of people were for it. We engaged in a vigorous public education campaign, making the same points I just said. We lost by 2 points. 49% of people thought it was a good idea. We'll run it again in 2020 and expect to win. So this is something that I think it just needs to be talked about more.
Right.
We need innovative ideas on how to improve our democracy, how to encourage participation. And we think this is an innovative idea that countries across the world are doing. You know, you have countries in Scandinavia, countries in South America that are doing this, and they see, you know, increased measures of civics education and increased measures of local voting. So it's something that we're interested in continuing to talk about.
I know you have an ambitious revenue strategy and you're looking to diversify your funding streams. Tell us a little bit about your business model and the sources of support that make all this great work possible.
Yeah, we've learned a lot about fundraising since we started, and I'm learning more every day. When I got into this work, I had no idea how to do it. You don't get into this work because you want to fundraise. You get into it because
you
like the mission, and so you learn as you go along. So, you know, we do have a diverse funding stream. So we have about 40% of our funding from foundations, including some big institutional ones like the Ford Foundation and the Hewlett Foundation that are showing an increased interest in civics education. Our model, we have six offices across the country, like I said. So Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, San Francisco, Oklahoma, and Texas. So we're trying.
By the way, I say I like that Oklahoma and Texas. So often organizations like this stay on the coast, but you've really gone to the center of the country when you're going to Oklahoma.
Yeah, that was really intentional, and I will say that was a decision that we made in 2015. So it was before the election, but I think we really wanted to say if we're a national organization that cares about ensuring that every young person in this country can receive an effective action civics education, we can't just work on the coast. And so what we've done is in those sites, we work with those sites so that they become self-sustainable. And so that includes a lot of local fundraising. So they're working with local foundations and local individuals that are invested in that work. And then we also charge a fee to schools. We predominantly work with low-income schools, but if we're able to demonstrate that this is something that is a core priority for their school, they'll put some dollars into it. We've also been really beneficial and lucky. We receive $500,000 a year from the New York City Council. So the past speaker, Melissa Mark Viverito, made this a priority for the council. We hope to work with the new speaker, Corey Johnson, as well. But the city, through the speaker, said, you know, it's a priority for us that young people are becoming active and engaged citizens, and so we're going to invest in this work. And so we really see this public-private mix is something that we'll continue to do going forward, too.
Fantastic. Let me close with this, Scott. With so many young people, especially from low-income communities, frustrated, disillusioned, and cynical about government and politics, what is your source of optimism that we can successfully change that mindset?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And if you read the paper in the morning, it sometimes it's tough to be optimistic. And I always think, you know, the bigger an organization gets, sometimes the less you actually engage with the constituency that you're working with. And so I really try to ensure that I'm actively listening and working and talking to the young people that we work with. And it's a little cliche, but what does give me optimism is when I talk to 14, 15, 16-year-olds that are not only passionate about making a change, but really conversant in the issues that affect their communities. And so I think so often on the national, we just get caught up in what the latest tweets say or what's the drama of politics of the day. And when you talk to young people, who are really facing substantive issues in their communities that don't necessarily pertain to the conversations that are happening on cable TV or in the Twitter sphere or on the front pages of the paper, but they're leading on these issues. And they're leading on these issues because they have experience in these issues. And I think that's what gives me hope, is that you are seeing a renewed spirit of activism.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a renewed spirit of activism on the local level. You're seeing young people recognize that active citizenship and politics is not a dirty word, but something that they can actually lead on. I guess the last thing I'll say is that whenever you've seen positive change in this country, it comes from young people. I mean, you can look from, you know, from the civil rights movement to the fight for marriage equality. Every movement is led by young people that don't see the world for what it is, but for what it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm incredibly lucky to work in a job where I get to every day work with young people that refuse to accept the current state of our politics and actively want to work for something better. And so I think channeling that idealism is something that we all need to do right now. And that's what we're trying to do at Generation Citizen.
And it is an incredible job. Well, Scott Warren, the CEO of Generation Citizen, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Tell us about your website. Is there a way for people to let you know that they would like you to come to their community, and how can they help support this work if they're so inclined?
Yeah, so our website is www.generationcitizen.org. We're actively engaged in a scaling strategy. Last year, we worked with 10,000 students. In 2019-2020, we want to be working with 30,000 students across the country, so we're looking for new communities to partner with. So you can just email us, info@generationcitizen.org, or my personal email, scott@generationcitizen.org, and we'd love to start a conversation.
Great. Thanks, Scott. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
A lot of fun.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.